everyone, welcome back to MiniMed Pods. My name is Xiao and I'll be talking about the upper limb neurological examination today. Before I start, I would just like to give a shout out to Bill, who requested for this topic, and Ajita Singh, who researched and co-wrote this episode. So thank you, Bill, and thank you, AJ. Just like the cardio exam episode, I will split this into two parts. The first part will be a quick, snappy, prompt-like guide, and this is to help you memorize the neuro exam, whereas the second part will be a more casual, and I'll try to make it as interesting as possible and try to elicit sort of like a discourse between you, the listener, and myself. So let's start with part one, the framework of the upper limb neurological examination. First, start with general inspection. Comment on posture, muscle bulk, abnormal movements, and the person's skin. Then check tone, followed by power. Then the upper limb reflexes you'll be looking for is the biceps jerk, triceps jerk, brachioradialis jerk, and the finger jerk. After reflexes, check coordination. You'll be looking at finger nose, rapid alternative movements, as well as the rebound phenomenon. Lastly, check sensation. Use techniques that test light touch, pain and temperature, vibrations, and proprioception. And that's it! That's the neuro exam! Both the upper limb and the lower limb neurological examination can be easily remembered using the following mnemonic. In tennis, Pat Rafter can score. For those who don't know who Pat Rafter is, he was a former world number one tennis player, but he was also famously known as the Bonds underwear man. Using the mnemonic, you will be prompted to test all the sections in order. Order is very important in neuro, as an issue in one part can actually affect subsequent tests. You can also use the mnemonic, in tennis, Pat Rafter can score, to prompt your hand over to other doctors. Part 2, an in-depth discussion of the upper limb neurological exam. Okay, so we started off firstly with general inspection. With general inspection and neuro patients, you're going to want to have a look at their skin, as well as also have a look at the bigger picture, such as their posture. So the best way to do this is usually to get them to undress as much as they're comfortable and you're comfortable to do so. And also be aware that the neuro population can sometimes be more unstable. So consider putting them in a seated or a lying position, depending on what their abilities are. Whilst looking at their posture, you want to look front on as well as side on. You're looking for symmetry of the shoulders, the knees, comment on any asymmetries. You can also look for specific postures, like classic posture associated with strokes is hemiplegia. This is where the upper limb is flexed, adducted, and pronated, and the lower limb is extended. You can also look for muscle wasting, which could indicate a denervated muscle, primary muscle disease, or disuse atrophy. Try to work out which muscle groups are involved. Comment on the pattern of wasting. Is it proximal or distal? Is it generalized? And also look for symmetrical as well as asymmetrical muscle wasting. Look for abnormal movements. Tremors at rest could be indicative of Parkinson's disease. And then if you have a look at the skin, you might be able to see muscle fasciculations, which are just spontaneous twitches. And these are commonly associated with lower motor neuron disease, but can also be benign. Look for skin lesions. You may be able to see signs of neurofibromatosis. This is a term for two separate and spontaneous genetic conditions. Neurofibromatosis type 1, which is the more common type, has a wide variety of systemic involvements and a large spectrum of severity. Some of the skin manifestations of neurofibromatosis, in type 1 that is, include café au lait patches, freckles in non-exposed, non-sun-exposed areas, so like the armpit and groin, Lisht nodules in the iris of the eye, which looks like a pigmented dome-shaped gelatinous mass, which is best viewed with a slit lamp. These are really rare. I personally have never seen them before. You can also see neurofibromas, which are nodules composed of nerves and their supporting cells. And it's really good to know that neurofibromatosis type 1 is associated with a higher risk of tumors, particularly of the nerve cells. These tumors can affect the optic nerve, the spinal cord itself, the brain. And this means that people with neurofibromatosis type 1 are at an increased risk of epilepsy, as well as learning difficulties and sensory defects. Apart from type 1, there's also a type 2. This is less common and it has fewer skin features. However, this one likes to affect auditory nerves. It likes to form vestibular schwannomas and acoustic neuromas. Be wary of bilateral hearing deficits. And if you see schwannomas / neuromas on MRI that are bilateral, because it's really important to have a look genetically if this person might have neurofibromatosis type 2. It can also affect other cranial nerves, and this can manifest as difficulties in swallow, speech, eye movements, as well as defects in facial sensation. These tumors can also grow in the brain and spine, which can manifest as epilepsy as well as difficulty with particular movements. The other signs that you want to comment on is cutaneous angiomata, which usually appears in a segmental distribution. This is associated with syringomyelia. You can also look for herpes zoster, which is also known as shingles, and this commonly causes post-hepatic neuralgia. You can also look for scars from old injuries or surgical treatment, and also note the presence of a urinary catheter. One thing to note is that everything we just discussed previously in the general inspection section can actually be used in the lower limb neurological examination. So let's now move on to signs that are more specific to the upper limbs. Unsurprisingly, we start off the upper limb examination with another general inspection, but this time more closely of the arm, the shoulder, as well as the shoulder girdle. So Tally O'Connor starts off with a very courteous gesture, and this is a handshake. So when you say hi, you can try to reach out to shake hands with your patient. And this can be very telling, because if a patient is unable to relax their hand grip after they've gripped onto yours, the patient could potentially have myotonia. Another thing to look at is arm drift. You can do so by asking your patient to hold their arms out with their palms upwards and then to close their eyes. What you're looking for is any evidence of drifting. So this is one or both arms drifting away from the initial position, and there are only three causes of arm drifting. The first one is due to an upper motor neuron weakness. This is usually demarcated by a drift downwards. The second is cerebellar disease. The drift is classically an upwards drift and slow pronation of the wrist / elbow. Thirdly, the loss of proprioception, and this is usually only seen in the fingers, so the fingers will change as opposed to the shoulder and the elbow. After looking at arm drift, you can look for, once again, fasciculations. So you can ask your patient to keep their arms relaxed, and usually the large muscle groups are the most obvious. So you can look for fasciculations in the shoulder girdle. Sometimes you can even see it in the elbow or wrist extension and flexion muscles. And what you're looking for is small contractions just underneath the skin. They shouldn't have any rhythmical pattern. Fasciculations can be described as coarse or fine and are present at rest. You might have also heard of recommendations to tap over the muscle to try to elicit fasciculations, but this school of thought is rather controversial. I mean, you follow your supervisor on placement, however, there's not really any real evidence that tapping is going to elicit a real form of fasciculation. Now, why are we so obsessed with fasciculations? Well, that's because there's a triad. So fasciculation, muscle weakness, and muscle wasting usually is indicative of degeneration of the lower motor neuron. Finally, moving on to the tennis section, which is tone. Here we're looking for the muscle tension at rest. This is a passive exam and the patient should be as relaxed as possible, and you as the examiner does all the work. Tone is tested both at the wrist and elbows. You can try the shoulder, but shoulders can be a little bit difficult to maneuver because arms can be really heavy sometimes. So what you're looking for is whether the tone is normal, increased, or reduced. Tone tends to be a spectrum, and when you first start, I know I definitely found it really tricky to know what is normal and what isn't. I would recommend you do is try to find as many people, not just patients, like try it on your family members, your friends, flop them around and see what normal tone is. And you'll find that tone actually varies from age to age. I think people in their 20s tend to have a higher tone, slightly, than people who are older or people who are younger. What you will find is you'll need to learn some pretty ways to prompt them to relax. So the ones that I like to say is stay floppy like a doll. Or maybe if they don't understand that, let me take all your weight. You can also try relax. Let me do all the work for you. And usually you'll get a giggle out of that one. I think a lot of people like to help us. They like to help us as clinicians, but this time you just have to say, no, I'm doing all the work for you today. Let me work hard. And that's usually enough to get them to relax. If this doesn't work and none of your prompting is working, you can either chat to them or you can try to distract them by getting them to say the alphabet backwards. So what does increased tone mean? Well, increased tone is also known as hypotonicity. And this is related to upper motor neuron lesions as well as extrapyramidal lesions. You can also divide this into two sections. So you got to test if the tone, the hypotonicity is due to spasticity, and spasticity is a speed dependent hypotonicity. This is specific to the upper motor neuron lesion. So examples are strokes and cerebral palsy, and this is caused by hyperexcitability of the stretch reflex. So how do you test for spasticity? So if you're in a safe place and you can take your hand, if you can use your hands, what you want to do, just testing at the wrist, is bring your hand up really slowly and then bring it up really quickly. Alternatively, you can also test it at the elbow. So keeping your hand, one of your hands really nice and passive. So what I'm doing right now is I'm keeping my right arm really nice and floppy. I'm taking my left arm, I'm bending my elbow really slowly. And then the next time I'm going to bend it really quickly. So that's an example of testing spasticity. And you can also do it in all different types of directions. So just now I was testing for elbow flexion spasticity. But what you'll probably see clinically is more spasticity in elbow extension. Moving on, the other type of hypotonicity that you might see is rigidity. And rigidity does have a couple of different types. So you've got cogwheel rigidity, which is a phenomenon associated with Parkinson's disease. This is a combination of rigidity and tremor happening at the same time. There's also lead pipe rigidity. This is hypotonicity in all movements. Lead pipe, so it's almost as if they're stuck. The arm is completely stuck in that one position. Then you have generalized rigidity, which is just generalized hypotonicity, which is associated with Parkinson's disease or Parkinsonism. And this can be due to other extrapyramidal lesions as well. I really recommend you to go on YouTube or perhaps try Physiopedia to have a look at all these rigidities because they're really quite fascinating. Moving away from increased tone, you have decreased tone, and this is known as hypotonicity or flaccidity. These are associated with lower motor neuron lesions. These can be more difficult to test because some people can fully relax and give the impression of hypotonicity. However, you can try to check by raising the arm, a patient's arm passively, and then basically just removing your hands all of a sudden. And if the arm falls suddenly, then you can assume that the tone is reduced. Usually in a normal person, if you drop their arm suddenly, the person, the start might be really quick, but the person will brain will probably usually catch on and try to protect their arm from just flopping all the way down, because you can really hurt and pull some muscles if you're not doing it properly. After tone, we move on to power. So this is the more active portion of the neurological exam for your patient, but unfortunately our workout is not over yet, because we'll need to use our ability to overcome the patient's muscles in order to properly determine their strength. So you need to develop a way to assess muscle strength joint by joint or dermaterm by dermaterm. The more you do, the easier it becomes. Usually in a general examination, and this is not in a neurological ward, this is just one of those quick run through, I would always check for shoulder abduction, shoulder adduction, elbow and wrist flexion and extension, and then some finger movements. So grip strength is really important. I also do finger extension as well as finger abduction and adduction. Some people like to do thumb opposition as well, as it's a very functional movement. Power is graded using the British Medical Research Council muscle scale, and it follows from 0 to 5, 0 being no contraction at all, and 5 being normal power. So one thing that's really important about this scale is the normal power bit can be rather subjective, and you need to be able to account for your patient's physical build. So you're not going to think that the 5 in a 21-year-old university student is going to be the same as a 5 in a 70-year-old retiree. If the power is reduced, ensure that you comment on whether the muscle weakness is symmetrical or asymmetrical. If you can, locate which muscle groups are affected, and also comment on what the location is. Is it proximal muscle weakness, distal muscle weakness, or generalized muscle weakness? After testing power, you can now move on to reflexes and finish Pat Rafter's name. In order to check reflexes, it's important to have a tendon hammer nearby. It's a really handy tool, and you'll mostly find heaps of them in the neurology ward, stroke ward, and the emergency department. However, I do admit there was only one in the emergency department that I was placed. Anyways, let's just say the tendon hammer is nowhere to be found. Don't fret, you can get creative. We all know the stethoscope trick. So you can actually, it can be a bit more painful for the patient as the stethoscope is not as rubberized, but you can use the stethoscope to hit the patient's tendon, or you can even use your phone if you have to, but I find phones are very difficult to control. So there are 4 main jerks or 4 main reflexes you need to test in the upper limb. A good way to remember is by starting distally and moving proximally. So start with the finger jerk. What you want to do is softly place the patient's palm upwards. You can let their fingers curl naturally. You place your fingers over those fingers that are curled up, and then you strike your own fingers just so you don't hurt them. What you can usually feel is a slight flexion at the patient's fingers. Moving upwards, you check for the brachioradialis jerk. This is at the lower end of the radius, just above the wrist. Again, pop your fingers on the top of the tendon and then strike your fingers. Usually you can feel a very small contraction, or sometimes you can elicit the movement itself. Then it's up to you whether you want to do the biceps or the triceps. I find biceps is sort of a smoother way to get to the top of the arm. So placing your finger on the biceps tendon, and this is quite a big tendon, so usually it gets easier and easier. Just like before, pop your finger on the tendon, hit your fingers, and usually you can feel the contraction. Lastly, the triceps jerk. This one I like to put their whole arm in sort of an L shape, so I get them to lift their upper arm so it's horizontal or parallel to the floor. I let their lower arm relax, and then usually I ask them to relax completely. This can be the most difficult to elicit because patients really try to help you hold their arm up, and that can remove the triceps jerk. You want them to relax completely into your arm, and then you hit the top of the triceps tendon, and you can usually feel a contraction, or sometimes you can see the arm swing out and try to hit you, which I find a little bit funny. Anyways, if you are unable to elicit the reflex, don't fret, it happens to all of us. Here are some troubleshooting tips. First thing is distraction. You can distract them easily by asking to clench their teeth, count backwards. It's really the key. What I like to do is start a conversation with them, but that can sometimes get in the way of you concentrating on where to hit the tendon. You can also position your non-hammer hand on the shortening of the muscle. So this can be a little bit difficult with the upper limb because you're usually using your hand to guide where your tendon hammer is going to hit. But sometimes you can, you know, try different positions and talk to the neurological registrar to see if there are any other ways that you can position your hand so that you can not only hit your fingers whilst hitting the tendon, but you can also feel the shortening of the muscle. Anyways, so you've finally got the reflex. So what on earth does it mean? So hyperreflexia, which is almost an exaggerated jerk, is associated with upper motor neuron lesions, such as strokes, whereas hyporeflexia, so the lack of the absence of a jerk, is associated with lower motor neuron lesions such as spinal cord lesions, disc prolapse, trauma, or syringomyelia. Each reflex is associated with a spinal level, and this is important to remember because you do get asked a few times, especially in anatomy exams. So the biceps jerk is associated with C5, C6. Triceps is associated with C7, C8. Brachioradialis is associated with C5, C6, and the finger jerk is associated with C8. Moving on to coordination. So coordination is mainly associated with cerebellar functions. So here we're looking for cerebellar signs. And we can do an episode, if you'd like, where we talk about the differences between upper motor neuron lesions, lower motor neuron lesions, and cerebellar lesions. But let's just talk about the upper limb cerebellar signs that we're testing. So the first one, which is very famous, is finger nose. It's as simple as it sounds. The biggest tip is ensure that when the patient is reaching out towards your finger, you're aiming for an outstretched arm. What you're looking for is intentional tremor, so that's tremor as you're going towards the target, as well as past pointing, so going too far. Then you can also check for rapidly alternating movements. So this is looking for dysdiadochokinesis. Probably one of my favorite words in medicine. So there are many ways to test this. One of the examples is almost as if you're supposed to be clapping towards the audience, except turn one of your hands downwards and then you're going to clap palm, palm, and then palm dorsal surface. Palm, palm, palm dorsal, palm, palm, palm dorsal. And you basically keep alternating their movements. Other ways to do it is to basically tap on the table. So you do left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right. That's also a form of rapid alternating movements. And any sort of signs of slow and clumsy discoordination is associated with cerebellar disease. And I think it would be very impressive to a neurological registrar if you could report, or if a medical student reported dysdiadochokinesis. I just think it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool to say anyways. To finish off the coordination section, you want to test for rebound. The safest way to test this is to ask the patient to rapidly abduct their arms away from their sides and then stop suddenly. If the patient has cerebellar disease, it can cause a delay in the sudden stop, and sometimes they'll just keep going. Alternatively, you can actually resist a patient's movement. So the famous one is resisting a patient's elbow flexion. You can do this by going to a position where you're going to do, you know, what they always do in bars, where they do the little arm wrestling wars. So you go into the arm wrestling position, but instead of trying to push them downwards and upwards, you ask the patient, pull your arm towards yourself, or pull my arm towards you, and you're going to elbow flex. And then what you can do is you try to remove your hand suddenly. But one thing to note is if the patient does have rebound phenomenon, they won't be able to stop flexing. So sometimes what that can be is they might continue to flex their arm and they may accidentally hit themselves. So it's really important. So, you know, Tally O'Connor prefers the abduction test. I personally think that's much safer for yourself and for the patient. However, I can understand that the arm wrestling technique is usually a little bit more exciting, or perhaps a little bit more attractive and easier to understand. Just be really careful when you're doing rebound phenomenon, basically, especially when the patient's got a cerebellar disease or a known cerebellar disease. Okay, we're now totally done with all the movement aspect of the neurological exam. We're now up to sensation. So before, I told you that there was lots and lots of different types of sensation techniques to test for. In the OSCE exam, I do recommend that you test for all of them. However, in clinical practice, we tend to only test for light touch, plus or minus proprioception. And if there are issues with light touch, then we'd go ahead and test for other things as well. Okay, so with light touch, generally I would recommend everyone to test in a dermatomal distribution, and you want to test left and then go directly to the right side. Don't test all the left sides and then test all the right sides, because you want to have a good comparison. To perform the light touch properly, you actually should use either a tissue tip or wisp of a cotton wool. And then you want to have two, because you want to compare both sides and say, is it same or is it different? So this is, again, talking about the left and right side. For the dermatomal distribution, may I recommend for C5, touch the tip and the outer part of the shoulders. For C6, the lateral aspect of the forearm or the thumb. For C7, the middle finger. For C8, the little finger. And for T1, the medial aspect of the upper arm and the elbow. You can also test in a peripheral nerve distribution fashion. So remember Mamu? Yes, so we start with the axillary nerve, which supplies the army band section of your arm. Then the radial nerve, which is mainly the posterior upper and lower, as well as the dorsum of the hand. The median nerve supplies the palmar aspect of the thumb, as well as the anterior aspect of the thumb. The ulnar nerve, which supplies the little finger. And then musculocutaneous is everywhere else. You may use either way to test for light touch during an OSCE. Both are definitely accepted. I personally like to use the dermatomal distribution, but I think that's just because I remember that a lot better than the peripheral nerve distribution. After testing for light touch, think about your spinal afferent nerves. So you've got the spinothalamic and the dorsal columns. Spinothalamic looks for pain and temperature, so that means you can test for pain using a neurology tip in the same areas, or you can use temperature, so you can use a mini ice pack or a cold metal, or you can also use a vibration fork, which tends to be quite cold. The other spinal column is the dorsal columns, and these are for fine touch, proprioception, vibration, and pressure. So testing for proprioception, you can use the up-down test. I'm sure you've seen people wiggling fingers lots in hospitals. The only tip I have to say for this one is ensure that you don't touch on the anterior and posterior area of the finger. You want to test from side to side, because patients can actually cheat by feeling the pressure. So if you push down and they feel lots of pressure on the posterior aspect of their second finger, they're going to say down because they can feel the pressure. So it's not testing for pure proprioception. You can also use a tuning fork, so the vibration testing with a 128 hertz. Now I have absolutely no idea why it's always in the written exam, but for some odd reason they always ask what hertz vibration fork do you want whilst doing an exam, because there's obviously the one that you use for hearing and the one that you use for sensation testing. So for sensation, it's 128 hertz, which is the bigger one. Okay, so you want to test it in order, go distal to proximal, and you try to go for bony surfaces. So you start off with the distal interphalangeal joint. If they're unable to feel that, then go towards the head of the ulna. If that doesn't work, then try the elbow and then the tip of the shoulder. For completeness, you may also perform a peripheral nerve exam. I've alluded to a peripheral nerve sensation exam before, where we test, you know, the Mamu areas. And you can take this a step further by also testing their motor distribution and also by using special tests. However, I think that this is outside the scope of the episode today. The other things that you can consider is testing fine motor skills, and you can do so by asking them to button a shirt, or you can test the key grip strength. You can also look for dexterity by asking the patient to play the piano, which I always think is a little bit cute, and you can also get them to write. Assessing the neck and back can also help you with your differentials by looking for any signs of trauma or tenderness. And finally, neurology stuff tends to come in a package. So now that you've done upper limb, it's also really important to consider performing a cranial as well as a lower limb neurological exam. So thank you very much for getting through all of this. I hope you enjoyed the episode. I know I try to insert a couple of corny jokes here and there if I can, although I'm not sure how well they come off on podcasts. Anyways, the resources that I used today were the Tally O'Connor Medical Students Bible, Rayner and Smale, S-M-A-L-E, I hope I pronounced that correctly, which is a physiology blog, and MedGeeks. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave us a message on Facebook if you want to be like Bill and request an episode. Again, Facebook is the best way to contact us. You can find us on Mini MedPods, M-I-N-I-P-O-D-S. We're also contactable via email on minimedpods@gmail.com. And for now, but not forever, I'd just like to say goodbye, and I hope you have a very lovely day.